open a public hearing on Senate Bill 289A, and we have two of the most illustrious senators from the other end of the building here this morning.
What have you been?
Senator Courtney and Senator Atkinson.
You're the star.
They're all together on the same bill. That's amazing.
It's a dangerous.
This is power, committee. This is power. Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Jason Atkinson, a senator from Southern Oregon, and we have brought our star witness. I will talk very briefly and also allow Senator Courtney to introduce himself. This bill started a year ago on behalf of a gentleman sitting up to my right, Aaron Matthews. Aaron was a senior at Grants Pass High School and brought this matter to my attention. And through lots of discussion, a senior project, and a lot of amending in the Senate, this bill now comes before you. And this bill has to do with bioptics. I'm not going to say too much until the other two stars have introduced themselves, but I'd like to talk after Mr. Matthews talks. Right now, I'll give it to Senator Courtney.
Good morning, Senator Courtney.
Good morning, Chair Brown and members of the House Transportation Committee. What I'd like to do is I'll introduce myself, and then I would like to go, as they say, to the young man sitting to my left, because the three of us made the same presentation in front of the Senate Transportation and Economic Development Committee, and I think you'll find his testimony not only interesting but compelling. For the record, my name is Peter Courtney, and I reside at 2925 Island View Drive North, and that is in Salem, 97303. I'm a state senator. My district is number 11, which includes portions of Salem, and it includes Brooks, Jervis, and Woodburn. With that, High and Supreme Chair Brown, I'd like to allow the star witness sitting to my left and do Senator Atkinson's right to be allowed to testify, please.
Thank you, Senator. Aaron?
Hi. Thank you all for coming and hearing my bill, and I'd also like to thank ODOT for working close with us to come up with a bill that pleases all sides. And like Senator said, my name is Aaron Matthews, and when I was 8 years old, I was diagnosed with an extremely rare disease known as Stargardt's. It's a juvenile form of macular degeneration, which specifically affects my central vision. Now, I've had to work extremely hard my entire life to overcome my vision loss. Last year, I graduated high school with a 3.6 GPA while taking AP classes and playing sports. Last year, my team took fourth place in the state 4A basketball tournament, and I received all conference honors. I've never considered myself to have a disability until I turned 16 and was denied the opportunity to get a license. The problem with the current law is that it creates a handicap that persons with low vision have worked so hard their entire lives to overcome. The law bases driving competence on one's ability to see an eye chart, when in fact many other factors play a more significant role that aren't specifically tested for, such as field of vision, color distinction, and fine motor skills, all of which most people with low vision excel at. The law does not give those with low vision the chance to show their skills and their ability to become a safe driver. Not being able to drive has become more of a handicap than my eyes have ever been to me. It does not allow a person to do the normal things and to interact in the way that a person of my age would. In choosing colleges recently, I'm not able to choose the college that I would like to go to most, but rather the college that has the best on-campus housing or the best public transportation. I can't choose the job that is to my liking, but rather the job that is closest to my house or that works around my parents' schedule so that they can drive me. It is debilitating to not be able to go where you are, want to, when you need to, and you have to have rides arranged to and from everywhere you want to go. It takes away your independence and does not allow you to be the kind of functioning member of society that most people are allowed to be. Now, many people are skeptical of this law because they feel that it is unsafe, that poor drivers will be put on the road. First of all, this is not a new law. Many states, including California and Washington, have already enacted similar laws allowing persons with bioptics to drive. In fact, the statistics have shown that, in studies, that there is no correlation between persons driving with bioptics and a higher accident rate. In fact, many studies also show that persons driving with bioptics are safer drivers because, in fact, when they get in the car, they know where they're going and they usually know the roads they are taking. And persons with low vision usually know their abilities and their limitations and are very careful about that. Now, this law is designed to where only the most functional and competent of those who would even qualify would be able to pass this law. What bioptics are is a pair of clear lens glasses with a small mounted telescope above the eye to glance through. Now, it is used specifically for spotting things, such as signs or a light ahead in the road. It is used less than 1% of the time. It is used if, per se, you were pulled up to a stop sign and you wanted to see directions to the next freeway and you'd look up ahead to see the sign. It's not that someone with my vision can't see the sign ahead, it's just that we cannot distinguish the letters on it. Now, bioptics are not the determining factor in whether a driver is safe or unsafe. Rather, it is just an aid to help them become a safer driver. Now, when I have driven throughout my lives, riding motorcycles and quads and even driving heavy equipment, I've learned that most of what driving is using your peripheral vision. That is something that someone with my vision excels at. If a child were to run into the road, we would see that just as well as you would. The only difference is we may not see the expression on their face that you would. Now, the Oregon Driver's Training Manual states that driving is a privilege and not a right. If this law is passed, we are not asking for the right to drive, only the privilege to be given the opportunity. To get this opportunity, we would have to go through an intensive driver training program, an eye exam, and we'd have to be reevaluated every 2 years at a full driving test and eye exam. Now, we'd have to be able to show our ability, our competence, and our safety at driving. This is done on an individual basis, and it seems that unless the DMV does not have competent workers, that how could unsafe drivers be put on the road having passed all these tests? Now, there's also been a sunset clause put on this bill, so that after 4 years, if it is not deemed to be safe by the statistics that are shown, it will be taken out of effect. I don't see any other amendments that we could possibly put on this bill to make it any safer for the drivers on the road and for the other pedestrians. The fact of the matter is that Oregon is behind the ball. Other states have already enacted similar bills. The statistics not only show that it is safe, but it is necessary. It gives individuals the opportunity to be more active in their communities. It gives them the opportunity to get jobs and go to school. It allows them to not be dependent on other people. So I'd strongly urge you to just pass Bill Senate Bill 289, not to give those the privilege to drive, not to give those the right to drive, but the privilege. Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron. Senator?
Chair Brown, I'd like to say a few words about this. Actually, I started to deal with this issue at the latter part of last session. And what happened is, and you have materials in front of you, there's a world-class woman runner in Eugene by the name of Marla Runyon. And I arranged for Marla to come and give the commencement address at Western Oregon University. And I was taken, because I was in charge at that time for the commencement at Western Oregon, how she was able to navigate down the street into the stadium as well as onto the podium, etc. And I drove her back to her home in Eugene. And we got talking, and I think accidentally this issue came up, because she had had a license like this years before in California. And I don't know whether or not I introduced a priority bill at the end of that session. Somehow I got into it, and immediately I got into a struggle with ODOT over the bill. Marla Runyon is not a crusader type of person. She is, you may have heard of her, you may not have heard of her. I have presented to you the story that just recently was published in the Oregonian about her, because of her bid to take on the very difficult and hard Boston Marathon. And you also have in front of you her written testimony that she presented to the Senate committee. But we got talking. At that time, she mentioned a young man by the name of Aaron Matthews to me, so I never knew our paths would cross. The point I'm trying to make here is that we worked very, very hard in the Senate committee, with the Oregon Department of Transportation, with optometrists and ophthalmologists, to bring you this piece of legislation. I'm taken by Marla's written comments. I find myself reading them time and time again, because she writes so very well. But if you watch the words she chooses, I am an advocate of the right to apply for the privilege of, and she goes on. She is very careful to point out she considers the right to to a driver's license. That is a privilege. She simply to apply for it. It's not guaranteed. She's very deferential towards the Oregon Department of Transportation as well as to others, because the last thing that she would want are individuals that have this condition, and us as a person who has the condition that we're talking about, is to promote or have individuals on our highways that would present a threat to them, and more importantly, perhaps to others. And my only reason to say this is I didn't know the bill would come up this session, and I was extraordinarily happy to see Senator Jason Atkinson bring it up, because I thought I would struggle again to even, I didn't think it would even have a chance to get through. And here we are today, a very successful effort in front of the Senate Transportation Economic Development Committee. It was a struggle. It was a struggle. I think, Senator Atkins, you admit that with me. We were back and forth, came off the Senate floor. I do not believe there was a dissenting vote. I believe today the Oregon Department of Transportation is here. The ophthalmologists, optometrists, at least and/or their representatives are here. So I think we put together a pretty good effort to allow individuals who have this situation in their life an opportunity to drive on our highways in a safe manner. So somewhat of a statement. I felt I should make it. It's been quite a journey for me. I'm very excited about this piece of legislation. In my legislative career, there'll be, if this is successful, there'll be a few things that I take more pride in, even though I was just strictly a bench warmer on this one, just got in a few minutes each game on this one. It's just one of those things that you can feel good about. So, Chair Brown, thank you for allowing me to enter that statement on the record, as well as providing you with the written testimony of Marla Runyon, as well as the most recent extraordinary sports story in the Oregonian, April 27th, about Marla Runyon and what she does in racing. I don't know how she does it. She was on the Olympic team, by the way. She was, she ran that famous mile run. She was in the mile, the last Olympics, took the lead, held the lead for the longest period of time. Eventually she faded. I remember she talked to me about it. She said there was no way she could beat those girls unless she got out ahead, sort of a pre-Fontaine mood early. She did not think she could beat them. She tried to wear them out, but it's just to be in the finals of the Olympic mile of the best women runners, mile runners in the entire world, given her situation, and to run with them for 3.5 laps. And actually she didn't come in last at all. She just wasn't able to finish with any of the medals. To just run the Boston Marathon, a marathon I'm very familiar with. I've never run it, but I have some connections back there. This is a brutal marathon. It's her second marathon, just that. Again, I don't mean to just use her as a star witness, because she talks so much about Aaron and others. She is a shy person, but I do think that she demonstrates that an individual like this, cautiously and carefully, would never want to put others in jeopardy. So thank you very much, Chair Brown and members of the committee.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Atkinson?
Thank you. Again, for the record, Jason Atkinson. A couple things. Foremost, far be it from me to be known as the senator who kept the Senate president on the bench. this bill actually has gone through a tremendous amount of changes, and I'll say that there's never really been an effort just to stop this bill, but there has been a collaborative process to get this bill where we kept safety as the main focus. And I think that's what you'll see if you read through the bill, if you'd like us to talk more about it, with emergency clauses and training and the fees for licenses and 2 years and vision requirements and vision exams and getting the acuity level at such a place where we would be able to help people like Mr. Matthews and Marla Runyon, but also at the same time make sure that the safety concerns were met. So I think you'll see a very collaborative bill in the A.N. Gross that's before you that took several versions and multiple committee meetings and several conversations out in the hall and et cetera, et cetera, through the Senate process to bring it to you without a dissenting vote. So we're very proud of that. But I wanted to signpost for you that safety was the number one thing that everyone had in order to make this move. Secondly, I think also just for you to keep in mind is that we're talking about a very small population of people here. We work very closely with the Low Vision Clinic, and I believe someone probably will be here to testify on their behalf. The Low Vision Clinic sees, without saying anything, statistic that I don't have at the top of my head, I believe the majority I guess it's safe to say, the majority of Oregonians who have this condition. And we know that we're talking about a very small population of people here, a very small population of Oregonians that would be affected by this bill. But nonetheless, as I said in the Senate and I said on the Senate floor, most of the reasons why we ran for office is to help people one by one, or to help senior projects one by one change the law or to change the world. And that's part of the excitement that we bring this bill to you. With those two signposts, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you have about how and why we changed the bill to what you have before you. But it's actually with some great enthusiasm that all three of us are here, and with that, answer any questions.
Thank you, gentlemen, for bringing this bill. And Senator Courtney, I realize the sixth man off the bench is really important, but I can assure you, you're not the sixth man, you're a starter.
Mr. Chair.
Representing Greenlight.
Could I ask Aaron a question or two about
Certainly. The
situation? When you use bioptic lenses for driving, do you wear them like glasses? Or?
Yeah, you wear them like glasses, but the actual lens, you're not looking through it the whole time. It's above your eye to where you only glance through when you need to see something like a road sign or a lane change ahead. You're just driving off your normal vision, so you're not looking through the whole time, but you like bend your head down so you can glance through it real quick.
May I ask a follow-up question? And it may not sound relevant, but it is relevant. I'm intrigued with how you played basketball and made all conference. Did you use lenses with that, or
no? I've basically lived with this longer than I haven't, so I've just had to learn to. It's the only thing I know, really. So I've just had to play, and I don't really know what it would be like if I had normal eyes. I can't really say. I just go out there and do the best I can.
You were having trouble catching passes. That's the thing that's relevant to driving, I think.
No.
I do with my trifle. Yeah.
I relate to that too. Every time I try to walk down the stairs,
Mr. Chair,
I admire you very much for that.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. If I could add one thing about the use of the bioptic, I think the best analogy that Mr. Matthews gave me was, it's similar to how we, all of us who have driver's license now, glance at the rearview mirror, or glance at the mirror on the windscreen, the one in the front. You know, it's just a small glance to make sure that you know what's around you. I think the best analogy here is that's the quick glance using the bioptic, allowing someone with this condition to see far away, is probably the best analogy.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, our esteemed senators and Senate President. Has the insurance companies been involved at all in these discussions? Is there any feedback from them on whether or not they have any hesitation at insuring?
Mr. Chair, I don't recall they have been involved. I don't recall they were involved in any time in any of the discussions. So I don't know how to respond to that except to say that for the record.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, why the 45-mile-an-hour speed limit?
I'll try that one.
I would just say the safest, just for safety reasons, because the higher speed you'd go at, the more you'd have to take in at time. You'd have to look farther down the road because that's obviously what you'd come encounter with quickly. So I would just say that's for safety reasons, just to make the law as safe as possible, just so that everybody will be on board with it, just the safest of all possible situations.
Chair Brown, Representative Zoner, when I was talking to Marla Runyon, she voluntarily told me she would never, like some of those California, you know, she's years ago lived in Southern California, she would never drive on some of those major freeways. She just didn't do it. And that told me that speed limit was an issue for her, and she did not want to take a chance. And I believe some of the other states, there's also this kind of limit in terms of miles per hour for these types of licenses. So we're sort of borrowing on the past, both in terms of other states as well as testimony of an individual who's had this disease for quite a while.
The other question, Representative Mayberry.
Do I understand correctly that your peripheral vision is not any different than anyone else's? It's just right directly in front of you that's the problem?
That's correct. The peripheral vision is the same. It's not that I don't see right in front of me. It's just that I don't use my central vision to see. Actually, my vision is adjusted to where when I'm looking at you right now, I look out of the corner of my eye. It's just a natural habit, and so just adjusting for not having central vision.
Following.
And then with the corrective lenses that allows you to see telescopically in front of you, does that not improve your vision to the 20/70? Is it still worse than the 20/70?
No. With looking through the bioptic, I think it would be up to 20/40 or 20/20, actually.
Oh, okay. So it's quite a lot of correction.
Yeah.
Aaron, do you wear contacts?
No. It's an uncorrectable disease.
I have one question.
Representative Dingfelder.
Reading through the bill, it looks like you'd be restricted to driving during daylight hours.
Mm-hmm.
And is that because the glasses don't work at night? Or I'm just sort of curious about that.
I just think that's another thing, just for safety reasons. Just like anything, darkness is something that makes driving more difficult, just like rain or snow. And I think that they're just trying to add in any limitations just to make this as safe as possible, like I said before. Me personally, I don't have a problem seeing at night, and I think that I would be able to do it safely, but I understand that not everybody has been able to compensate as well as I have, and so I think it is a good thing to be as safe as possible with it.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for bringing the bill. Could I have Wayne Schumacher? And Kelly, Taylor, would you like to come up too at the same time? Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Wayne Schumacher. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. We're here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 289. I think there, as was alluded to, and I don't know that I could put any more than just an exclamation point on the testimony of our last three witnesses. I think Mr. Matthew did an exceptional job explaining what the issues are and what the devices we're talking about. The Oregon Optometric Physicians Association has a low vision committee. We work with not only optometrists but also ophthalmologists, and it's a central position that we came to that we could work with this bill and make it something that actually improved the ability of individuals that have these kinds of problems, allow them to be productive people in the community. As Senator Courtney indicated, we worked with a fairly large group to come up with a bill that essentially went from one page to multi-pages in a very short order. And I'd like to commend Kelly Taylor from ODOT. She did a tremendous amount of work to get the intricacies that are necessary to meet the requirements for the law. Basically, in a nutshell, it essentially creates four criteria, which were our initial recommendations, and that was that in the best eye, best lens correction of between 20/70 and 20/200, previous to this or as it exists right now, if you don't have 20/70 best eye, best corrected, you can't possibly get a license. This raises the bar to 20/200. And initially, I think that was the biggest discussion, was to become comfortable with that. We pressed fairly hard on that because we know that if you have 20/70 vision, best eye, best corrected, you technically don't need this device anyway. This allows folks who just have a little bit worse vision, and 20/200 is the largest letter on the eye chart, essentially. The issue is not the ability to see movement and things in front of you. The issue is to be able to read a sign, to read a speed limit, And in some cases, some more detail, but other than that, somebody at 2200 literally can function on the highway. We also wanted to make sure that they had a visual field that measured 120 degrees horizontally and 80 degrees vertically, that their vision is essentially stable. In other words, the condition they've got won't be deteriorating quickly in the next couple of years. The individual must complete a formal driver rehab training program, and that's explained much more in detail in the bill. The individual does have to take and actually pass a on-road driving exam. And then when issued, only daylight only can they drive. And then it requires them essentially to renew their license every 2 years so we can get an idea if there is a progressive issue going on here, et cetera. I think the criteria that's been spelled out in the bill, and again, I commend ODOT for their work on this, has created a fairly safe set of criteria and requirements to get somebody through this. And as was indicated, we're probably talking about 150 individuals maximum in the state who could potentially even begin to think about applying for and using these devices. I would like to answer Representative Dingfelder's question with regards to daylight use only. And seeing is the process of processing light, and the lower the light, the worse the vision gets, even for us who might not have an impairment. So that was the reason for the daylight only. We believe that this bill does allow individuals who have visual impairment to at least have the chance to become productive members in the society, to earn an income and hopefully pay taxes. So we would certainly urge your support in passing this bill with a due pass recommendation. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Wayne. Any questions? I represent his honor.
How many potential drivers do we have in the state of Oregon, would you guess, that could use this law to help them?
Our Low Vision Committee, Representative Brown and Representative Zahner, probably maybe a total of 150 might be able to make that. Again, you'd have to be able to train to use the devices to demonstrate to a rehab individual that they're okay to go to the next step, which would be to go and do an on-road test. So once you get through that step, I would suspect you're probably talking about 100 folks.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Could I comment?
Certainly.
The folks who are visually impaired are productive citizens and do earn their own way. This will just make them do that a little easier.
Definitely.
Kelly?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Tater with the Department of Transportation, and I just want to give you a few facts that we came across as we were working on this. Oregon, along with about 20 other states, currently allows you to use a bioptic device while driving. The difference between today and this bill is today you must in Oregon meet the minimum vision standard of 20/70. And then if you use the bioptic to drive, that's okay. But you cannot use the bioptic to meet the minimum standards. You must have 20/70 vision or better in order to have a license in Oregon. So, yes, there are many states, about half, not quite, that allow bioptics to be used while driving, but they have minimum vision standards. There are only 7 states that allow up to 2200 to be acceptable with a bioptic. And this would make Oregon the 8th. And those states, when I did the research, did put restrictions on for daylight driving, slower speeds, etc. Did not allow the bioptic to be used, I think one or two states might have, to meet some vision standard, but not all the way down to 2070. So I wanted to let you know that. And California did have a research project that was done in 96 that compared the accident rates of folks with bioptics to folks without. And they found that people with bioptics had nearly 2 times as many accidents as those without, and nearly 2 times as many injury or death involved in those accidents. So there are some statistics on bioptics and accident and injury and death rate out there. So I wanted to at least let you know that. We have worked with the group to come up with as many safety pieces as we can. But I will tell you, we still have reservations about the bill because, as stated, or not about the bill, but just the policy in general, because as stated, you only glance through the telescopic device, giving yourself good vision intermittently. Most of the time, you're driving at 2200, and in Oregon, that is considered legally blind. And so we still are concerned, but believe the bill has some things in it that are much better than the original bill.
Any questions from Kelly? Janet?
I have one question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Process is the person can use the bioptic to get a permit, driver's permit, and then has to go through a rehabilitation program
and then can get
the license?
No, Mr. Chair and Ms. Atkins, the way this would work, the first thing we have to do over the next year, because this doesn't go into effect until July of 2004, we have to work to set up what the standards and criteria would be for the rehabilitation training and find people that are qualified to do so. And there are only a handful of states that even offer this. In fact, in Mississippi, the folks that live in Mississippi have to go over to Tennessee to attend the program because Mississippi doesn't have a program like this. So it is very, very unique, this rehabilitation training. It can be very expensive. In some states, it's several thousand dollars to go through the training because it's pretty intense. What you would do is you would, if you came to the DMV and you applied for a license and we discovered that you didn't meet the vision standards, you could then go to your eye specialist to see if you are one of the people whose vision would be aided by a bioptic device. And if so, then you could be fitted with that device. You could apply to attend the rehabilitation training, come to us showing us that you've enrolled, take the law test to make sure you understand the rules of the road. Obviously, you're not going to take our vision test because you don't pass it. And then we would issue you a temporary permit to use while in that training program, because you need to have something to allow you to drive with this person training you to drive with using the bioptics. We will send that temporary permit to the school. You attend the school, the training, learn to use the bioptic in traffic. And then when you've completed the training, you bring the completion proof back to the DMV. You then take a drive test with us. If you pass the drive test, you are then issued either a restricted driver permit, because perhaps you'd like to practice some more, you're not ready to just jump to an individual license, or you could be issued a driver's license. Either the permit or the license would be restricted to daylight driving only and speeds of 45 miles an hour or less. And then in 2 years, now remember, we issue an instruction permit is issued for 2 years. A driver's license is issued for 8 years. So we would issue you either the permit or the license. In either case, you will be called back in 2 years to go back to your eye doctor to make sure nothing has changed that would change their recommendation for you having the bioptic, and for you to go through another drive test to make sure you're still operating safely, and then continue on. Now, with the sunset in the bill, the reason the sunset was put in is because there are only a little bit of statistics out there. This would allow Oregon to sort of pilot this and tell what's going on, and you all could make a policy decision in the future whether or not to lift the sunset. If the sunset is not lifted, what we will do is around June of 2008, anyone who had been issued or had currently had a permit or license like this, we would send them a letter telling them that it would be canceled as of July 1, 2008 if the law has not been continued on. They would not get to keep the license because presumably you've made the choice not to continue the law. So that's how this would work.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Ingvallner.
I have a question for Kelly. Regarding the cost of the program and who pays the cost, I see that on page 7 there's been added an additional fee for the learner's permit of $13 for special limited vision condition learner's permit. As far as the training, is that cost borne by the applicant?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, yes, it is. And it's whatever the provider believes is necessary to charge. We will not be controlling that any more than we control the fees that are charged for commercial drive schools or anything else, any other kind of rehab training that goes on.
Right. Just a quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
But you would be certifying, or would you be providing a list of names of people who can provide the service?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, yes. We would be working to establish what the training needs to encompass and then certifying who is qualified to then teach that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Greenlight.
Yes, I so I understand that this bill will apply, I guess, I'm not sure who I'm asking.
Doesn't matter.
Not only to people with macular degeneration that have normal peripheral vision, but to people whose vision specifically, I mean, whose total vision is at that 2200 level. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, you're absolutely correct. It essentially just indicates that if you have a visual acuity problem within these realm, with this realm, then it would essentially allow you to go through this process to try and gain that privilege to drive.
Can I follow up, sir?
Hold on.
It seems to me there's a huge difference in the functional ability of somebody with a 2200 central vision and a 20/20 peripheral vision in terms of their ability to drive than somebody with a 2200 total field of vision. Was there any consideration about this? I mean, well, first of all, I assume that is correct, is it, that, that about the functional ability of somebody with normal peripheral visions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, you're absolutely correct. And the standards which we looked at here between the 2070-2200, which is raising, again, the level, the bar, somebody who has 2070 acuity without any kind of disease problem, glaucoma or macular degeneration, can drive, frankly. There wouldn't be any problem. And before my eyes were corrected, that's about the vision that I had was a 2200. The issue comes down to is really is once you get to that that level, are you able to use the device? If you're not able to use the device for whatever reason, you can't functionally work it or whatever, then you're not going to be able to move through the criteria anyway. So whether or not it's a disease-related issue, macular degeneration, glaucoma issue, and again, peripheral versus central vision, et cetera, or simply an overall acuity deficiency, it doesn't seem to make a difference, in our opinion, at least our low vision committee anyway, who works with these folks. I hope that answered your question. And one thing I want to make crystal clear, I hope everybody has a comfort level with this, is what we're talking about is a best lens correction. That would be your eyeglass lens. You're not getting a vision of 20/200 with use of the bioptic device, okay? So I don't want anybody to think that, you know, you're using the bioptic device to pass that 20/200 level. I hope that's clear.
Representative Gilman.
Just a little follow-up on that, because that's about, before I was corrected, was 2200. And by reading this, I did assume that we were essentially going to let people that could not see any better. I mean, I could barely see the door from right here now. So I was a little excited, but you say the device needs to, will increase that. We're not saying how much, but at least to where they could see the signs.
Oh, absolutely, Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman. Absolutely, the device is another prescriptive lens, which is essentially like a telescopic device. That's exactly what it is. So it allow you to be to bring closer and to focus on a sign, a speed sign, a directional sign, etc. One of the reasons that they 45-degree speed limit was set was because, obviously, if you're driving faster than that, these things come at you much quicker. So you have to be able to drop to that, to focus on that, and then to interpret it.
And Mr. Chair, if I might follow up. Mr. Chair, sure. And Representative Gilman, I just want to clarify, that is still our concern because, yes, you have the device that allows you to intermittently spot as you would glancing once in a while in a rearview mirror. But most of the time, as you're looking through your glasses, you are seeing at 2200. That is still our concern.
Then a follow-up. Then why did we raise the bar so high? I'm wondering why it isn't 2140 or something like that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, in the Snellen chart, which is the accepted chart for tests, which we've all used and obviously ODOT uses, the break is at 2070, then goes to 2100, and then goes to 2200. And so we deliberated with regards to raising the bar to 2100 And then the 2200. Again, we're going on the recommendation of our low vision committee, which works with individuals such as this all of the time, and they're indicating at 2070, literally, most people wouldn't need the device to drive anyway. You could drive without it. Again, that's best lens, best corrected, best eye, best corrected lens. So, consequently, the 2200 was is again where most of the states are that do have this in place. And I would indicate that, well, I'll stop there. California has a little different idea on things. So,
Wayne, could you describe to me what a person sees with 2200 vision? How blurry is it?
After testimony in the House, I was trying to figure out a way to try and provide some sort of a visual aid. It's extremely difficult to do that. Not understanding what your visual acuity is, if you removed your glasses, hopefully you have an idea. But essentially what you end up with is...
I can still see you.
Okay, well, that's good. Now you have me worried.
But you're much better looking.
That's what we hope. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, essentially you're seeing, you're lacking the detail. You can pick out an object, a silhouette, et cetera, but you're lacking the detail, the expression, the name on a car in front of you. You can't read the license plate, obviously. You can possibly tell there's a license plate. But again, as we're moving down the road, the biggest issues we're dealing with are objects coming from the side, or possibly an oncoming car that's making a turn and a signal. That's the kind of thing. You can pick up the light. You can't distinguish the lens. At 2200, you can see that there is an object up there for a sign, but you can't read the sign.
Mr. Chair,
Representing Mabry.
The young man, when he was testifying, said something that struck me kind of humorous, and I don't mean to make light of it, but he said, you only use a lens when you want to see something, which really makes me nervous. And I know he had a bigger comment than that, but that was the word that was used. But am I understanding correctly about peripheral vision that, you know, right now as I'm looking at you, I can see George, but I can't tell if he's smiling or frowning. But I have corrected 20/20 vision because I'm not concentrating on it. And that's what you're telling me is the normal peripheral vision that the young man has. It's just right in that narrow focus point in the middle that is the 2200. And that's because he doesn't use any correction. That's what he would be driving with, except when he looked through this narrow little telescope. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, Mr. Matthews has a rather unusual condition in that he can see just fine peripherally, as well as probably any of us in our best corrected, best eye, best corrected. He cannot see forward.
Yeah.
That's a condition that's essentially from macular degeneration. Glaucoma, on the other hand, is a very tunneled concept. It's like you were looking like this, so you get no peripheral. Okay. So consequently, the field of vision that we've set up as a criteria we think is very important. Because in reality, your peripheral vision is almost more important than your front vision situation. So Mr. Matthew is a rather unusual situation in that, frankly, he could probably drive without any problem whatsoever. He'd just be essentially out of the corner of his eye. You make those compensations in that particular situation.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Greenman.
Yeah, that was where I really wanted to go. I mean, I'm not sure why we... It seems to me Mr. Matthews has learned to compensate very well, and the bioptic central lens, it seems obvious to me, will take care of his problem. I wonder why we didn't differentiate that situation from the situation of people with just... I think having a bioptic lens to use for central vision and having normal peripheral vision seems extremely safe to me. But I wonder why we didn't differentiate that from the total field of
It's an excellent point. Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick. I think that's an issue that, or a point that we probably haven't focused well on, no pun intended. They have to clear through an optometrist or an ophthalmologist, first of all, with a recommendation that they would be potentially aided by using this device. Not in all cases would they. And that comes at the level of the practitioner. No ophthalmologist, no optometrist is going to advise this individual to move forward with this process if their vision deficiency is not going to be helped by this device. So that's your first line of defense.
That is the professional certification then?
Yes.
That with the device, they will be a safe driver. That's what's being certified.
Yep.
Kelly, the way this measure is, they would be limited to roads with where the speed limit was no higher than 45 miles per hour. So that pretty well limits it to an urban area, right? Wouldn't it? I think most county roads or rural highways would be 55. So they,
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
It'd be mostly just in town.
Mm-hmm.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question. You said seven states are doing this. It would appear from the testimony of Marla Runyon that had been submitted that California has been doing it at least since 87. Is that, I mean, are they? Is that the longest running program that's out there, or have they all been running for?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beyer, there are about 20 states that will simply allow you, if you meet their minimum vision standards, to use a bioptic to enhance your vision while you're driving. But there are only seven states that have gone as far. Most states end at 2070 or so. A couple go to 2200. Almost all states, 2070 is the worst corrected vision they would allow. There are seven states that allow up to 2200, and California is one of them. I do not know how long they've been going.
Any other questions? Thank you, folks. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 289A and open a work session on Senate Bill 289A. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll move 289A to the floor with a DPAS recommendation.
Representative Greenlick moves Senate Bill 289A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Beyer.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Right now my comfort level isn't real high, and so I think I'm going to be a no vote here, but I may change when it gets to the floor. So.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Gilman.
Mr. Chair, I'll be a yes here, but maybe a no on the floor.
Thank you. Any other comments? I myself, when I first read the bill and heard the bill, I had a lot of reservations how this was going to be accomplished, but I am, with the testimony today, I feel a great deal more comfortable with it. Not saying 100%, but more comfortable.
I would like to put a statement on the record. I think it's very important to give folks like Mr. Matthews the opportunity to live well in society and to achieve the potential that they have. I am going to be relying on the vision specialist to make sure that what happened just happened, and having this sunset is, I mean, what we just said would happen, that they will be certifying the safety, the ability of a driver to drive safely before they even get into the rehab process. And when it comes back to us after the sunset, I think we'll have a chance to see how it's going. So my comfort level is relatively high. I think it's a small number of drivers, and I think it's an important issue to try and make sure folks who work hard to overcome what might be handicaps to some are able to do that.
Thank you very much. Any other discussion? Seeing none, Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlick.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
No.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Do we have a carrier for the floor? Representative Greenlick will carry the major for us. Thank you. Yeah. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 471A. Janet, can you give us a rundown on the bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 471, and you should have the A and gross version of the bill, requires persons that perform pack or loading services, including movers of household goods, to register with the Department of Transportation. And there's a fee set up in the bill, an annual fee for providers of these services. These are people who do not arrange for the transportation but may drive the vehicle and also pack and load a vehicle for a person. This bill was brought by the Oregon Consumer League and introduced by the Transportation and Economic Development Committee in the Senate. Mr. Chair, there's proponents of the bill and the Department of Transportation.
This is Russell's Sherpa bill, right? The Sherpa is registered.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Jason Reynolds and Bob Russell then, please? Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Associations, and we'd like to start you out with a little video this morning.
Okay.
We're not going to show all of it to you, but we're going to show you a few minutes so you get some flavor of what we're talking about.
Stop. Tonight's Dateline hidden camera investigation.
Thank you,
Dad. Here is Don Phillips. Good evening. You're packing up your home, your memories, and moving out. Every year, millions of Americans entrust all of their belongings, their furniture, electronics, their family photos, and heirlooms, to total strangers with trucks. Most movers are honest, but a new breed is cropping up, ready to take your business and then take you for everything they can. And if you don't pay what they ask, you may never see your stuff again. Here's Victoria Cordieri with the Dateline Hidden Camera Investigation. Tyrone and Regina Kelly started off the year ready to leave Massachusetts and gamble on living in Las Vegas.
We were looking forward to being able to experience all these new wonderful things.
They arrived in Las Vegas last January. Once they got their belongings, this new life they'd envisioned would begin in full. Once they got their belongings.
It would never occur to me that it would be possible for somebody to steal all of our stuff and get away with it.
They found out about an ugly little secret in the moving industry. And once you learn the secret, it's too late.
Too late because by then you're standing in your empty new home. And all of your belongings, everything you own, or somewhere else. And the only way to get them is to pay what some consider ransom. Sounds like a crime, right? Sounds like a situation where someone, the police, the government, someone could help you. As the Kellys and many others are finding out every day, not necessarily when it involves the moving industry.
Our Dateline investigation, including our own moves documented by hidden cameras, reveals that though many in the industry are honest, many others are taking consumers and all of their belongings for a ride. The Kellys found the company New York-based U.S. Movers on the Internet. Their estimate, based on weight, was $1,482 for a cross-country move. The Kellys paid $100 down. The Movers arrived in Las Vegas a week late with a shocking announcement.
They said they wanted $3,600, or they said we're not going to have a moving truck.
U.S. Movers claim the Kellys' belongings weighed some 2,500 pounds more than the original estimate, and they provided these weigh slips, which they say prove it. Weigh slips show how much the truck weighs empty and with the load, but Tyrone says he didn't believe it.
I was thinking, what in the world are these people trying to pull? They must think I'm stupid.
Tyrone says he requested a reweigh of the load, but the Movers refused unless he paid the full amount first. He told them he'd go get the cash, but instead went to the police.
What was their reaction when they said he'd come back to the police office?
Oh, they were stunned. they were stunned. But they weren't intimidated.
Maybe because the drivers already knew something Tyrone was about to find out from the police officer. Most of the time, police consider this a contract dispute, a civil matter, not for law enforcement. The police left, and the movers drove away with Tyrone's belongings.
I said, this is, I'm being robbed here. It certainly seems criminal to me.
So for the next 3 months, Tyrone Kelly went on a frustrating odyssey, pleading his case to state and federal agencies, politicians, consumer groups, law enforcement, all to no avail.
In the past 3 months, I've had a chance to do a lot of legal research, and a whole slew of federal laws have been broken here.
But if that's so, then why are you still sitting here in an empty room?
That's the question I ask myself every day.
It appears that Kelly's new start in Las Vegas had become a dead end. So we asked Tyrone to retrace some of his steps.
The officer over here at this office?
This time with Dateline, and we would ask the question. First stop, a storage facility, where U.S. movers was holding Tyrone's belongings. The manager wasn't there, but we spoke to him by phone.
Mr. Atlas?
Hi, Victoria Fedora, the State 186.
Hi, I'm here with Tyrone, and can you explain to me why you can't get a change there?
The manager said he couldn't help, because the problem was between Tyrone and the moving company.
I mean, the bottom line is you're saying that anything short of a court order will keep this man stuck in storage.
You've experienced for yourself what I've been dealing with now. Next stop, the Las Vegas Police Department. Another place where, Tyrone says, no one would listen to him.
How many times have you been here?
Three times.
Tyrone Kelly for Lieutenant Spinoza and Detective Morris.
Suddenly, with our cameras there, Tyrone's luck seemed to change dramatically. Detective Spinoza came out.
We're trying to follow up on every place he has gone to try to get credit accounts.
Absolutely. And he agreed to meet with us.
It's been several months now, and I'm tired of sleeping on the floor when my stuff is only a couple of miles from my house in the storage facility.
Tyrone will tell you the truth.
This isn't, it's not a simple burglary, it's not a simple robbery. I mean, there's a lot of tentacles on this thing.
Do you think this can get resolved?
Are we done with the cameras?
With the camera off, Lieutenant Spinoza came up with a plan.
Okay,
the police took the extraordinary measure of convincing a judge to issue a search warrant on the grounds that U.S. movers attempted to obtain money under false pretenses.
Okay, get one of them in the unit.
Yeah,
that's it.
Police unloaded the unit and headed for a weigh station. Finally, the argument would be settled. U.S. movers claimed that Kelly's belongings weighed 4,650 pounds.
Okay, the difference is 3,460 pounds.
Vindication. It was the proof Tyrone had been waiting for. U.S. Movers was trying to charge the Kellys for 1,000 pounds they didn't have. It turns out Tyrone was right. Tyrone, who had paid only a $100 deposit, never spoke to the moving company again. But we did. U.S. Movers declined to be interviewed on camera, but told us Tyrone agreed to the increased estimate ahead of time, and they had the right to collect the full amount before any reweigh. U.S. Movers also said they did not use false weigh slips regarding the Kelly shipment, yet they didn't provide any explanation as to why the Kelly's belongings weighed 1,000 pounds less than what U.S. Movers claimed.
Now it feels real.
Now the Kellys say they finally will be able to live their Las Vegas dream. It turns out this is a happy ending in a sea of hard luck stories.
My family refers to this as the Echo Chamber.
There are many others.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this tape goes on for an hour, and we're just trying to give you a little bit of a flavor of some of the problems. And with me today is Jason Reynolds from the Oregon Consumer League. He's actually the sponsor of the bill, and he's had some real-life experiences in this area.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Transportation Committee, Jason Reynolds with the Oregon Consumer League, and thanks for being to hear this. These kinds of abuses happen here in Oregon. We go to the police. They don't respond for it's not a burglary. DMV and Department of Transportation don't have jurisdiction. The Department of Justice doesn't have jurisdiction. The Department of Consumer and Business Services doesn't have jurisdiction. We try to get an address from the corporate division. They're not incorporated. We try to find out if they're licensed by anybody. We can't. And finally, I decide I'll go there myself and talk to them, yeah, except they don't have an address. This bill fixes that. We did a lot of work. We had a joint committee, and we worked together on a bill that would solve most of these problems with a minimum of change in the law. And I can give you specifics about what the people in Oregon go through, but it's this. The estimate doubles or triples. And if you don't pay it, you don't get your stuff back. Most of the time they hold it to a storage unit in Washington State and claim it's interstate, which it's not. So these are local moves. Lake Oswego to Lake Oswego, Portland to Portland. And this happens to them. So with the particulars of the bill, I'd like to reintroduce Bob and tell you about that.
Thank you, Jason. There was also an article in the Oregonian in February that described a lot of the same kinds of things that were going on in Oregon. I have a lot of members that are household goods movers, and they have been concerned about this activity for a lot of time, for a long time. I mean, it from their perspective, it's a blight on the entire industry. Last session, we introduced House Bill 2817. In its final form, what it did was set up a task force. A task force was administered by the Department of Transportation. Jason was on the task force. I was on the task force. There was a moving and storage company. There were the telephone companies, and there were two different people from the Attorney General's office. There was one from General Counsel that was dealing with ODOT's regulations, and there was another one from the Consumer Protection portion of the Attorney General's office. The task force worked for 18 months. A lot of the things that we came up with in the task force, we really didn't need legislation for. for example, the Department of Justice can prosecute these people now that they are aware that this is a major problem. Under their consumer protection laws, they can in fact prosecute them. The telephone companies agreed to put in public service ads in the yellow pages to make people aware that ODOT is a resource, that they can get advice from ODOT on these kinds of things if they have a problem. They can start with ODOT in order to address them. However, there were a couple of things that we couldn't do under existing law. This bill really does two things. The first thing it does is there is a group of movers that are legitimate that are called pack and loaders. And basically what they do is you rent a U-Haul. They come in, they pack up your stuff, they load it into the U-Haul, they go to destination with you, and they unload it. There are very legitimate pack and load companies, no question about it. However, there are some of them that are not so legitimate. So what this bill does is it requires pack and loaders to register with the Department of Transportation and provide proof that they have liability insurance to cover the consumer. And the Attorney General's office was a strong advocate for the registration provision because, as Jason was mentioning, they have a difficult time finding some of these people. If they register and provide an address and that kind of information, then in the event that they do something that violates the consumer's rights, they have a place to find them to serve the subpoenas to do all of that kind of thing. Second thing this bill does is you folks may be aware, and those of you that were here last session are most definitely aware, there was an Attorney General's opinion that was issued last session on the appropriate use of highway funds. And one of the things that it said is that if ODOT does not have the ability to stop a vehicle from operating on the highway, then they can't use state highway funds. And in this particular case, if the company is not regulated by ODOT, it's not licensed by ODOT, under current law, they cannot investigate because they can't use highway funds. So the second thing this bill does is it sets up a fee on my members, moving and storage industry, and it would go into a consumer protection fund that is separate and apart from the highway fund, and that money would be used to fund the investigations. There is another little piece that this bill does, and it was included in the amendments on the Senate side. Since at least 1935, all transportation companies, railroads, pipelines, airlines, truck lines, all of them, have been covered under a uniform statute dealing with cargo claims. Under that statute, a consumer has 9 months to file a claim. Now, back in 1935, that was probably a really appropriate period of time. You might receive a rail car load full of goods into your warehouse, and it may take you a number of months to actually go through it before you actually could determine if you had any damage. Today's world is much different. And so what this does is just for household goods movers, it doesn't affect anybody else, it changes that 9 months to 3 months. 99% of all consumers of household goods companies file their claims as quickly as possible. In rare instances, they will delay, and what happens is nobody can remember what happened. So in some instances, it actually works against the consumer. So that's the other little thing that this does. At the end of this tape, which we didn't show you, they interviewed Congressman Petri. He's been involved in this area for some time. He currently has legislation pending in front of Congress to also deal with this problem in interstate commerce. Our bill deals with it in intrastate commerce. Congress is looking at legislation that will deal with it in interstate commerce. It is a significant problem. It is a consumer protection issue, and we strongly urge your support. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Mabry.
In some of the testimony I was looking at here, it talked about a moving mover picking up goods in Lake Oswego and hauling them to Vancouver. In this particular case, since it's intrastate commerce, this wouldn't correct that problem. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, maybe yes, it would. The original intent of the shipper was to move it from Lake Oswego to Lake Oswego. That's clearly intrastate. It was a subterfuge to move it to Vancouver and try to convert it to an interstate shipment. The Attorney General's office has indicated that because the original intent was intrastate, that they would prosecute that one rigorously.
Okay, and this bill regulates pack and loaders, but, you know, John Mabry, the smoother mover that does it all, is not regulated by this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, there is already significant regulation of the household goods moving industry, my members. They are very heavily regulated.
One more.
Follow up.
I'm just curious, and I'm not sure you can answer. I see the Senate vote was 21-5. This looks to me like something that is a good bill that deserves our support. What were the five objecting to, do you know?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, sometimes things get connected to other things in this building. I would suspect that maybe that there was another issue that day that might have caused some folks to vote no on this bill. Clearly, it was not in any danger of failing. It passed out of the Senate committee on a unanimous vote. I think it's a good bill. We really haven't encountered any objections other than there was a person that testified in the Senate committee. And originally, we had the definition so that it wasn't entirely clear. The person that testified was concerned that the way we had the definition of pack and loaders, it may sweep in if you wanted to have your friends move you, you rented the U-Haul, and at the end of the day, you paid them off with pizza and beer. There was concern that those folks may be included in our definition and then would be swept in. We did amend the bill to make it crystal clear that those folks are not included. That's not the intent at all.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Ingram.
Thank you. Fortunately, I never had a bad moving experience. I feel pretty fortunate. But obviously, if I did, it would be helpful to have some recourse. What I'm trying to understand, though, is the fee structure. If maybe you can walk us through it, because sure. I see in Section 3, Subsection 2, there's an annual fee. In Section 5, there's a fee, and then you discuss it in Section 8, where the fee's going, and then under Section 7, sub F, there's another fee. So if you can explain the different fees, are they overlapping, where they go, and what they'll be used for?
The fee on the pack and loaders has a cap of $100.
And that's in
Section 3.
In Section 3, sub 2, okay.
Correct. Looking at the fiscal analysis that ODOT provided to the task force, it certainly doesn't appear that the fee will have to be that large, but they wanted a cap, and they will set it by rule. That money will also go into the Consumer Protection Fund. Under Section 5, and that particular fee is the one on the household goods movers, my members, and that is 0.1% of their revenues. There are other states that impose similar kinds of fees on household goods movers. That clearly goes into the fund as well. You pointed out that the fund was set up in Section 8, and all of these monies would go into that fund and would be separate and apart from the highway fund and could be used to conduct these investigations and to provide the registration of the pack and load members.
Follow-up? So could you explain Section 7, sub F? It says the person registering under Section 3 for the first time shall pay an initial application.
Okay, I apologize. There is an initial application fee of $200, and then the annual fee is up to $100.
Follow-up? And that's for the pack and loaders
only? That's for the pack and loaders, correct.
And does your folks also have to pay an initial fee at some point?
Some of my folks have pack and load operations. They are treated exactly the same as the pack and loaders, and yes, they would have to pay the fee.
And one last question, Mr. Chair, I promise. When this account was set up and the task force was looking at, mm-hmm. I mean, you must have had an end figure estimate from ODOT saying we think this is going to cost so much to register, and if we have X number of claims to review them, is that how you came up with an initial registration fee?
Yes. ODOT recognized that initially the registration function is going to be more intensive than the annual renewal. So that was why there was a difference in the fee for initial registration and for the renewal.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Janet, you got a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, I guess, for either of you. So go through a scenario where I've used a registered pack and loader and something goes wrong, I don't receive my things, and then the same scenario, but I've used an unregistered pack and loader. What are going to be my recourses if the bill passes?
Okay, great. If it's registered, we go to the Department of Transportation and the Department of Justice. If we can't deal with it by making a phone call, sitting down with the business and reviewing the documents. If it's unregistered, we then can, I would call the Department of Transportation under the provisions of this bill and ask them to investigate. With the idea that if it did turn out to be criminal, because they're not registered, among other things, it would be referred to the Department of Justice, and the consumer would then be protected that way. I also could refer it to an attorney because I have an address. But if they're unlicensed, I don't have an address, and I would have to get that from Department of Justice because they could subpoena records from the telephone company and so on. Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
A representative's honor.
Bob, in the film, the people that were breaking the law there had some Waymaster bills that they weighed their trucks at 1,000 pounds more. Where did they get them weighed? Did they falsify those, or did they have extra stuff in the truck?
Mr. Chairman, representative's honor. There's a variety of ways that people in the household goods industry have historically accomplished that. I have actually seen cases where the mover will fill up the garden hoses with water and then screw them together so that the water doesn't leak out to add more weight. I have seen instances. I spent my early career was in the household goods industry. My family had three household goods agencies in New Mexico. I have seen instances where they have what they call portable scales, which basically are a set of dies, and they get a blank weight receipt or weight ticket, and then they take those dies and they punch in the numbers that they want. They're actually, the shipment is never weighed. They just create a false weight ticket. There are a number of ways that can occur.
May I add something? Mr. Chair, Representative Zahn, it's curious that the weight always seems to come up in such a way that it doubles or triples the bill. Just so I think it's faked entirely.
Thank you. Any other questions? Janet has one more question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what if I'm going to move, I get the U-Haul, and I give a friend $40 for coming to help me move? How is that friend not in trouble under the bill?
Because when you look at the definition, it says pack and load services means service relating to the packing or loading of personal property that are performed by a person that is in the business of performing such services. Your friend is not in that business. You're just helping them out with giving them some extra cash.
Thank you.
Yeah. Looks like no more questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard Burke, please. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Burke. I'm the executive director of the Libertarian Party of Oregon. This came to our attention when a number of pack and loaders came to us and asked us for help, believing that they were not being adequately represented by the trucking lobby, and some of whom didn't want to be singled out. I have taken the owner of one of those companies and gone to a private meeting with Representative Brown, so you can be assured that that is real, and I'm not just making that up. But I'd like to also say that I have great respect for Bob Russell in the Oregon Consumer League. I don't agree with him on this bill, so I don't want what I say today to be construed as being negative upon them. And this is a legitimate issue, which I agree has to be addressed. However, this is not the right bill. What this really is, in my opinion, is corporate welfare disguised as consumer protection. This bill is one of thousands and largely fell under the radar of the Senate, which is why I think it got by. I talked with Senator Beyer and Senator George, and they talked to some people. That accounts for the five. I did not have a chance to talk to more. I did not have the time. But I think if folks are more educated about this bill, it would have been stopped or at least significantly altered. So it got by them. Hopefully it won't get by you. And I do have an idea that I think could fix this, which I'll try and get to a little bit later. But first I want to go to a point of evidence. If you're going to begin charging people fees and requiring that they submit financial records to demonstrate that they're paying the adequate fees, I think you need to have some documentation that there is not just a problem in Oregon, but a significant problem in the Oregon worthy of the creation of a bureaucracy, invasive business practices, and fees. And what are we brought? We are brought anecdotal evidence of a move from Lake Oswego to Vancouver, and we're brought a video from Dateline NBC. Dateline NBC is a tabloid magazine which always goes for the most sensational bent on an issue. They're biased. They also have questionable integrity. These are the people that tried to create news and later had to apologize for it by blowing up a car. It's not a scholarly statistical review, which should be the prerequisite of any legislation which changes the complexion of a segment of the transportation industry. And the story itself was not at all relevant to Oregon. Having said that, I have several objections to the bill. The fee structure, which will be in place, is unfair. As Mr. Russell said, there is a $200 first-time fee and a $100 annual fee, but there is also a third fee on some movers, which constitute a 0.1% of gross revenue. This is a tax imposed on a subset of movers, which is inherently unfair and provides one segment of the industry an advantage over another segment. You can argue which segment has that advantage.
Representative Greenwood.
May I ask a question? Is that a new, is that one-tenth of 1% added to this, or is that an existing?
Yeah, it is, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick. It is on the Section 5, Paragraph 2.
Do you have a page on that?
It's page three. I guess page 3. They're not really numbered, but I guess it would be page 3, about two-thirds of the way down.
Line 27.
Okay. Thank you.
Now this fee has to be documented by the company, so they have to provide proof of their gross revenue receipts, and they are subject to be audited by the Oregon Department of Transportation, which you'll find further down on that page. This is unnecessarily invasive. And we think it is wrong. Not only is it wrong, but we have had no estimates from the bill's proponents as to how large the industry is or what the gross receipts are likely to be. We understand that they asked ODOT, but ODOT has been right sometimes and they have been wrong sometimes. We have no figures on how large the industry is, so we have no assurance that the gross revenue tax and the fee structures will be adequate to pay for a bureaucracy which is responsible for registration, monitoring and enforcing registration, and carrying out audits and reviewing the review. That is going to be a substantial expense, and we could end up with a general fund liability coming from this. Okay, I'm trying to find my place on the list here. Okay, now, the bill is still badly written. In its original form, it was written so if I invite a bunch of guys over and pay them pizza, beer, or $20, they would technically be guilty under this. And it was amended in an attempt to correct it. And it mostly corrected it. But let's say that, Representative Zahner, let's say you're my buddy, and you happen to move for XYZ Moving Corporation. And not under the auspices of the corporation. I'm saying, hey, I've got a pickup truck and some guys are helping me move. Would you help too? You could tell us what we're doing wrong. You would still be liable under this bill. So they didn't completely close all of the loopholes, and that would be one correction that I would like to see made under this.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dean Cromer.
Mr. Burke, what would your suggestion be to close that loophole?
I have an entirely different strategy. I think that I've written up an amendment request that is in the mill right now for this bill. I don't have language yet. But what it essentially does is make an estimate enforceable within plus or minus 10%. Mm-hmm. And if, let's say that you're a moving company and you give me an estimate of $1,000 and you say it's $2,000, obviously beyond the 10% limit. If I sue you, then I would be able to also recover attorney's fees as well. What this does is this covers all movers. Doesn't matter what segment of the industry it is. And so it provides a much larger degree of protection. You have a written estimate. And when you have a written estimate, you have a name and an address to contact somebody. It is a much more elegant solution, can be handled through the civil courts. And because of the attorney's fees, if you have a good case, a consumer can find a lawyer to take it on a contingency basis. And it doesn't require the construction of a bureaucracy, the imposition of fees, or taxes or audits or any of those sorts of things. The reason why the small movers came to me on this is because a lot of their profit margins are thinner than those of restaurants. And they're already facing tremendously onerous regulations. And they're saying that many of them will either be shutting their doors or moving up to Vancouver and operating out of there, where the Department of Transportation restrictions are much more business friendly. And I would submit to you that in the current economy, even small businesses, we don't want to be adding to corporate flight. We don't want to be adding to unemployment. And because of the nature of the work pack and loaders do, you're talking about people who don't have a great deal of education. You're talking about people who might be on the margins. And in this technological post-industrial economy, these are some of the few jobs that they're actually able to get. And if they lose these jobs, they'll be more likely to commit crimes, end up on social service agencies, and have a tremendously higher cost. This way, they're making money, they're paying taxes, and they're investing in themselves the fact that they have a job to go to. What some of us believe this is the large trucking companies, which dominate the trucking lobby, wanting to get rid of competition, which frankly undercuts them. And this would do it in many ways, because the cost of the fees and the cost of complying with the various filing restrictions is more than these companies want to bear. So, as is the case with many businesses, they're saying, you know, let's get out. And this is the little guy we're trying to protect here. And I didn't have a chance to share this with most of the senators. And those who I did have a chance to share it with were very sympathetic. And so I, you know, after it got through the Senate, there was more time. I met with Representative Brown and a variety of others. I think I contacted your office through your aide and some others, and these are issues that have to be made. I want to applaud the Oregon Consumer League and Mr. Russell for identifying this as a legitimate consumer issue, and I hope it is addressed. And I'm happy to work with either of them or anyone else in trying to craft an amendment that would either make this bill workable or take a different strategy, such as the one that I've embarked upon myself. But I would say that at minimum, this bill needs more work. I know time is getting short in the Transportation Committee, so rather than sending it to the floor, if you don't want to wait for the amendment, wait for us to work with it, I'd ask that you would refer it to Ways and Means or Business, where it could be crafted a little better. So that is the meat of my testimony.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you. You talk about them being under a lot of regulation now. So what regulation are they under that's more onerous than the larger packing and moving companies?
Well, I'm sorry. Perhaps I wasn't clear. I didn't mean to imply that they were under more regulation than the packing companies. I would expect that in some respects, They're under more than others. They may be under less. I'm not an expert in the trucking industry, but what they do tell me is that the state of Washington is more friendly to loaders and packers, movers, and actually a variety of different businesses. And I think that's part of the phenomenon that we have seen about businesses moving up into Vancouver, going out of state. And that's what a number of the loaders and packers who are concerned about this bill have told me they intend to do if this bill passes.
Follow up.
And what kind of consumer protections do they have in Washington for?
Well, I haven't read Washington law. However, I note that Dateline NBC was Massachusetts to Las Vegas, not Washington, not Oregon. And also, this bill doesn't provide consumer protection. There are all sorts of regulated businesses in all sorts of industries today which are regularly convicted of fraud, or convicted of a variety of offenses, and this doesn't prevent any of that. All this does is make a list of loaders and packers, and if you had a binding written estimate, you'd still have a contact point. So it's a much more elegant solution than this one is, which is going to create an expensive bureaucracy, impose fees on a subset of the business, and drive some of them out of state.
Another quick follow-up. Mm-hmm. At this point in time, is there a requirement, or in your amendments, is there a requirement for a contract, written contract?
I'll have to check my language. If there's not, I'd be happy to insert it.
And now, is there?
I've written it up. It hasn't come out of LC.
No, I mean in current law or current regulations, is there a requirement for a contract?
I don't know.
Thank you.
But I would like to investigate the possibility of making sure that's in the amendment that I'm working on, if that would be helpful.
Is there any other questions? Hearing none. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dinkelman.
Would it be possible to ask Mr. Russell to come back up? I have an additional question as a follow-up.
Certainly.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Russell, I just was curious if the form of oversight that was proposed by Mr. Burke was discussed in the committee. You know, because he did have a work group that was looking at this, and I'm just curious if that was looked at in it, and if you feel that would provide the same sort of oversight that the proposal that you're looking at.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, let me try and confine my comments to just your one issue. In fact, my members, the household goods folks that are regulated by the Department of Transportation, right now they are limited to, they provide an estimate, and they're limited to plus or minus 10%. The consumer can take delivery of their goods for the estimate plus 10%, and then they have their goods. They're not in this situation. And then any dispute over the remaining charges, then they can work out among themselves. Mr. Burke made some comments about the 1% and having a lot of different, providing your financial information. Those people are already required to provide their financial information annually to the Department of Transportation. It's not a new requirement. And again, these are my members that are providing the 1%, and they strongly support this legislation. They're willing to pay the fee.
Representative Greenland.
Thank you.
825.240 seems to exempt small local cartage organizations from a set of regulations, ones who are under $100,000 a year in business or in small towns. Would that, and that $100,000 is, one-tenth of 1% is $100 for a $100,000 organization. Would these small companies still be exempt from some of these regulatory provisions?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, under Section 5 of the bill, the one-tenth of 1% is on the regulated household goods movers. And no, they would not be exempt. There would be a minimum of $100 that they would pay. But again, these are my members that are already regulated by the Department of Transportation, and they are willing to step up to pay the fee. Like I said, the requirement to file their financial information is already there. There's no new regulation as far as that's concerned. They are heavily regulated now, but there is no new regulation, and they are supportive of this bill.
If I may follow up. Mm-hmm. Are those companies that are defined as for hire carriers of household goods who are engaged in local cartage?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, that's correct.
So smaller companies now of those are exempt from a variety of regulations.
The pack and loaders absolutely are exempt.
No, are these pack and loaders, is that for hire carriers of household goods?
Those are my members. I'd have to see the provision to see exactly.
It says they're exempt from, if they're under 100,000 or live or are in a city of less than 10,000, they're exempt from a variety of some of the regulatory provisions, and I would assume they would remain exempt. This doesn't know anything about that exemption for small.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, that's companies. Correct. Yeah.
Representative Beyer.
Thank you. And I don't know if you have any comments to some of the questions I asked, but the one in particular I wouldn't mind following up with you on is the Washington issue, and if things are so much better there, what type of do they have much in the way of consumer protection?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beyer, Washington also regulates household goods movers. Washington also charges them a gross receipts fee to pay for that regulation. In terms of how much teeth they have in their consumer protection regulations, I really am not that familiar with Washington. And that it would be better there. I mean, the regulatory structures in Washington and Oregon, at least in terms of the full-service household goods movers, are very, very similar.
Another quick follow-up. So, as Mr. Burke mentioned, that some of the pack and loaders are talking about moving to Washington to run their business, then how would that affect our ability to get at them in the intrastate as opposed to the interstate?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Breyer, the fact that they live in Washington doesn't change the essential character of the transportation. If they were providing transportation within between two points in Oregon, they would still be subject to the consumer protection laws administered by the Department of Justice, as well as the requirements that we have in this bill.
Thank you.
Committee, my intentions are to bring this bill back either Wednesday or Friday, so I'm going to close the public hearing now and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 183. Representative Miller, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, State Representative Randy Miller, District 37, and I'm here to ask the committee to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 183. The amendments would do essentially a couple of things, and that is revisit a bill that this committee already has passed and that the House of Representatives passed with a substantial margin, and that is to raise the or allow the speed limits to be raised up to 70 miles per hour based on decisions made after hearings and review by the Department of Transportation. And the second essential point of these amendments would be to make the 70 miles per hour and the rule of the road on those such highways as a basic rule as opposed to a limit. I'm sure this committee, more than any other, is certainly familiar with that distinction. But as you know, and I would simply surmise this, that in all situations, whether there is a posted limit or not, the basic rule is in effect. All drivers understand that. The publications put out by the Department of Transportation, DMV, all talk about the basic rule and that you have to drive what is reasonable and prudent given the circumstances. I believe that that ought to be the standard on all of our highways, and in this particular case, for these highways, the exclusive standard. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I thank you and the members for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have and appreciate in advance the further review you might have to give the self-service gas bill.
Thank you.
Is that a bill we have?
Maybe coming back to you. We'll see.
It's Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, you told me it's out of order when I talk about bills. Representative Miller, you could help me as a freshman trying to get educated on these issues. Why there is an issue of the difference between the basic rule for certain speeds and maximum speeds? I mean, it seems to me I've only lived in Oregon about 40 years now, so I have a little trouble understanding what that basic rule really is and why a speed limit shouldn't be viewed as a speed limit, although with some flexibility by the enforcement officer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, I think probably your last aside there kind of touched on the issue that there ought to be some flexibility in this particular situation on these more open stretches is what I have in mind with this particular amendment. And it has to do with a trust factor, I guess, of Oregonians, again, in certain stretches of highway, that we should respect their judgment, which is, in effect, what, in many cases, law enforcement has been doing. I think most of us understand the situation now with the dual observation of 65 on freeways, that it is true you could be cited if you were going 70 miles per hour, let's say, right now. You could be cited for two violations, violating the basic rule. You could be going too fast under the circumstances, and you could be cited for violating the maximum limit, the speed limit. Under the first set of circumstances, it's a rebuttable presumption that going over the posted number that you have committed some wrong. By being a rebuttable presumption, you can go to the courthouse and you can say, Your Honor, you know, it was a beautiful day, there was no traffic, my driving was reasonable in the circumstances. And in that situation, his or her honor could say, you know, I agree with you, it was reasonable, we're tossing this ticket aside. If, however, then came before that same judge the suggestion that you were driving 70 in a maximum 65 mile an hour speed limit situation, the issue isn't whether or not your driving was reasonable, it's whether or not you violated the number, whether or not you exceeded 65. So even at 66, you can be effectively cited and found to have violated the law by traveling 1 mile per hour beyond what the legislature decided was the fastest you are allowed to go, no matter what the condition. It's an arbitrary, absolute limit. And so the proof problem is simply, was the radar gun recently tested, was it accurate? And if the answer to that, or if you fail to contest, is yes, you're done. You're fined. So I don't find that a situation that we should sanction in these stretches of highways. I have confidence in the driver's ability to make good decisions and drive at a reasonable rate, given, again, the suggestion, strong one, that whatever the posted number is what we believe in good judgment to be a reasonable and safe speed given good circumstances. You exceed that, given that you could argue that going faster was reasonable, but that's not something most Oregonians want to do, frankly. I hope that answered your question.
It's still a puzzlement.
The difference?
No. Well, I understand the difference, but I don't understand is the concept that underlies
one of the things when I,
the
well,
differences.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenleg, I was thinking that when I was preparing to go to law school many years ago, my father, who was a lawyer, he observed to me that there are there's the common law and then there's statutes. The common law was basically seen as common sense. They were decisions by jurists in many cases based on sets of facts, and out came the decision of the judge, and that was what we hoped was common sense. Then he said, but what the legislature does is they create rules of departure. I said, what's that mean, Dad? And he said, well, that's departure from common sense. And to the extent that we now say that drivers, you know, we don't care if it's beautiful and sunny and straight and flat and clear, that 65 is the posted maximum, we don't care what situations would deem reasonable. We're saying you can't go over 65. That would be, in my judgment, a departure from common sense. And that's the kind of rule we have today in the dual system. So I'm hoping that we can simply live by common sense.
Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, now that you've insulted all of us for having departure from common sense. But one of
we're politicians. Yes, right. We've never been insulted.
Never. One of the, I guess, challenges I'm having with this concept is that and I, you know, understand your description about common law versus statutory, is that what may seem reasonable to you may not seem reasonable to another person or another driver. And that's where I see that every day, as I'm sure you do, driving up and down I-5, you know, somebody doing 70, driving, you know, 2 feet from somebody else's bumper may seem that that's reasonable, where, you know, I feel much more comfortable having more of a distance. And the conditions may be safe as far as not having rain or whatever, but the fact that they're going over the speed limit and there's a lot of traffic, it leaves it a lot more subjective. So you're saying that you feel comfortable and reasonable driving that speed, but somebody else might not, and it's going to be up to them in court versus the, you know, the officer issuing the ticket to say, no, I felt that this was okay because of these circumstances. So I guess if you have any response on how do you define reasonable? I mean, with a speed limit, we're saying, you know, if you exceed that, you exceed it, and you exceed, break the law. And under, if I'm understanding right, under basic rule, you're saying, you know, it just depends on the conditions, and if it's safe to do it, then you can do it. And am I understanding that right? Maybe you can help me here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, again, reflecting back on old law school days, I can remember probably approaching some of my classes with that same concern, particularly when I would read in case law what damages were reasonably foreseeable, what is reasonable and prudent under the circumstances, which, after all, is our basic rule. It seems a bit elusive, but really most Oregonians don't have a problem with spacing, as you've suggested. I don't think anybody, if you said for somebody, they might find it reasonable to tailgate at 75 miles per hour on somebody.
They don't do it.
I think most Oregonians, and certainly most jurists, if that's why you were cited, would probably believe that the judge made an appropriate decision if you were following too closely at a high rate of speed, or at any rate of speed, frankly, going too closely. But the basic rule states that you must drive a speed that is reasonable and prudent at all times. That's our current statute, is the basic rule. It applies on all streets and highways, even where the maximum speed limits are also set by law or posted. To obey the basic rule, think about your speed in relation to other traffic, including pedestrians and bicycles, the surface, the width of the road, hazards at intersections, weather, visibility, and any other conditions that could affect safety. And so that standard has been in our law for as long as I can recall, and would continue to exist. And again, most motorists drive reasonably. And it's the few that behave in a different manner that are cited by our officers on the highways, and they will continue to pay penalties. But I don't think this would cause any concern but for the convenience, frankly, of citing people for violating what is reasonable and simply saying that you went faster than this number, therefore you're guilty. I don't frankly think that that's necessarily a standard we should condone.
Representative Mabry?
I take it this change would, in effect, anyone that's driven from Arlington to Pendleton on a sunny day, as opposed to Portland to Salem on a rainy day, acknowledges there are some difference, and yet they're posted the same speed limit. I take it this would allow the police officer to make that differentiation of saying 75 between Arlington and Pendleton maybe is a reasonable speed, as opposed to 65 if you're tailgating between Portland and Salem. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mabry, I concur that an officer would observe the flow of traffic and the conditions of the day and determine whether or not that motorist was proceeding in a reasonable and prudent manner. And as you know, even driving less than the posted number in certain conditions could also be a violation of the basic rule. Because if there was out in that part of the country some ice or some very poor conditions, you're not justified in going 65. You need to drive what's safe and prudent given the situation.
Follow up.
My recollection also is in years gone by when there almost wasn't, it was rare to see a posted speed limit. That's back when you and I were kids. The police officer, given their huge experience, were recognized as experts in the field, if you will, and given, under basic rule, a little bit more weight to that testimony. Is that still a correct assumption, or does it make a difference?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, I can just assume that, I'm sure their testimony is given great respect, as it should, in the courthouse. A rebuttable presumption simply means that a citizen can go in and contest their finding. It'll be an evidentiary matter as to whether or not the court would agree to dismiss the ticket or uphold it. Most citizens, I'm guessing, don't look forward to a trip to the courthouse to explain their driving habits or behavior. If you believe that what you were doing was reasonable, then I suppose you'll go or you'll write a letter and try to reduce the bail, whatever many people currently do would continue to exist. Again, the only thing that'll disappear if this happens is that ticket that is not based on reason wouldn't be issued.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Miller. I spent Saturday morning meeting with a number of judges down in Lane County who were berating, the budget and the fact that they just can't get to everything that they need to get to, and that why, in God's name, are we passing more laws to put more restrictions on the book that they aren't going to be, they can't handle what they have now. We're going to ask them to handle more. In my mind, I see this as putting a little bit more burden because people are going to start arguing, whether it's by letter, whether it's going in, saying, in my mind, I was going the speed limit, according to conditions. And I see that a little bit in this bill, and I wouldn't mind a response from you on that one.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Byer, I don't think there would be a huge increase in the number of people who would contest citations. As a matter of fact, right now you can be issued under this dual situation we have, the both citations, and you can still go in and argue with respect to the reasonableness of one of them, of the violation of basic rule. If you feel that way today, you'll feel that way even after this bill passes. I don't think it's going to be a great incentive. Most people probably figured that their time is a bit more valuable than spending it in court some afternoon awaiting their 10 minutes to go argue with a judge about a ticket. Most people, frankly, I think, do everything they can to avoid going to court, even if it means paying your $75 fine or whatever it might be, to not go to court. So experience, I don't think it'll indicate that there was a great new number of people that go in to do this, but nonetheless, I think we need to deal with what is the right policy. And this is all about believing that our drivers would continue to do what they're doing today, and that's most of them driving reasonably.
Any other questions? Representative Greenland.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Miller, this is an interesting colloquy we're having here, and I'm absolutely enjoying it. And essentially, we're talking about what human nature is, and we're asking ourselves what's behind drivers. And, of course, when we do that, as a great psychologist as I am with huge experience with empirical data, I know I always say, well, what do I think as a way of dealing with rational situations? And it strikes me that except for a psychopath or somebody who didn't have proper mental capacity, everybody feels they're driving safely when they're driving, regardless of how safe, how unsafe it really is. I mean, that idiot that's driving around the lanes is obviously believing he or she are driving safely. And when I violate the law by driving, I mean, and I don't ever remember whether the freeway is a basic speed or a maximum. I never think that. If I'm going faster than 65, it's not that I am driving safely. I know. Harriet doesn't agree with me, but necessarily, but I know I'm driving safely. And I'm violating, and when I put my cruise control on 77, it's not that I think it's okay to do under the basic rule. It's that I know I'm violating something or other, vaguely, and I'm thinking, well, I've talked to state police. I know what the enforcement situation is. I'm not going to get a ticket for doing it. So I'm driving safely in my senses, what safe is, and I'm thinking about what the enforcement limits are, and sometimes I'm going to be wrong about that. I mean, because somebody's going to give me a ticket one of these days, although I haven't had one for about 40 years. But it seems to me understanding that I'm violating the law in the same way it does when I look at a charitable item and find out, well, did I really get a dinner along with that, or can I put the whole $100 on my income tax as a charitable deduction? It's not that I know if I put it in, I haven't violated the law. It just thinks, well, the law's stupid in this case, and nobody's going to catch me. Although I wouldn't do that, for the record. It seems to me it's just easier in life to know that there are some limits, that they're explicit limits, and that sometimes you violate them, and sometimes a common sense legal system will let you violate them because it makes sense to let you violate the laws under certain circumstances. And I've always felt that the basic rule, the only time it really applies is when I get caught at something and I talk to my lawyer about it and I say, what's my defense? I mean, now I understand the basic rule. Ooh, wait a minute. I just have to convince the judge I was doing it right. But it seems to make sense to me just to have speed limits as speed limits. And even though I violate them, and I know lots of other people do, and I'm dependent on the state police to say, oh, okay, he's going 12 miles. That's all right. It's not a big problem. I'm having trouble groping with the concept that says don't have speed limits, have the basic rule. And I'm not asking you for an explanation, I guess. I'm just debating with myself here. Yeah, I hope it's not pontificating. I'm trying to take this internal debate I have about it external and see whether you can help me with it at all. And pontificating is not a bad thing, but I think I'm not doing it right now. I do it when I'm acting.
You should be the judge of that.
I'll defend this on the basic rule about I think it's not pontificating.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, I just think your practice is not especially uncommon, given I'm sure you don't set that cruise control in excess of the number unless the conditions warrant. And all I'm suggesting is that Oregonians ought to have that same privilege and would set it probably at a number in the great majority of cases that is reasonable. And we've already argued in this committee and on the floor the merits of posting a more rational number, and that's well settled, and I'm confident that the majority of Senate members would approve of that, and I'm very confident the governor would sign that concept. What I'm suggesting is that in your situation, if you were on a stretch of highway that was hardly occupied, it was straight, it was sunny, and you set that cruise at 75 and the posting was 65, I would hope that you wouldn't be, as you could be, ticketed successfully for simply violating a number that really wasn't based in reason. But also I would say that even if you adopted these amendments and the Department of Transportation posted whatever number, 65, 70, whatever it would be, that doesn't mean that you're automatically authorized just to keep on going. It means that you have to continue, as you do today, drive reasonably, and that if you violate that standard, you can be cited. So it continues to ask Oregonians to behave themselves on the highway in a reasonable manner. And it also does not dispense with limits in other situations, through neighborhoods, school zones, places where we've determined that because of the other factors being so present, of children, of automobiles, neighborhoods, a lot more cars in most cases, you cannot exceed a certain number. And I subscribe to those. But what we're talking about here are the more rural stretches where I think the reasonable, the basic rule ought to suffice.
Oh, I do need a brief follow-up.
Okay. We're running out of time.
I understand. In the bill we have in front of us before these amendments, it sets limits in cities and basic rule outside of cities, except on the freeway. Is your only problem with that the fact that the freeways will have limits? Are you okay with limits inside cities?
Well, not necessarily on interstate highways.
Excluded the interstate highways within cities.
It's also, I think, further limited by the size of the city.
I don't know.
Is it not? No?
I don't think so.
The federal law was 50,000 or
I think this is just cities. Inside cities are limits. Outside cities are basic rule. The only exception to that being the interstate highways. And is your only problem with that being the interstate highways?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlake, I would suggest that to the extent a local authority has control over designating a speed for a roadway, if it's a county highway as opposed to a state highway.
The state statutes define those, I've been told, right? You mean like school zones?
It's the state statute
that's defining it.
I would defer to the administrator probably on that, or whoever wants to.
There's a, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlake, there's statutory speeds that apply county or cities for school zones and residence districts and things, then a county has the ability to apply to ODOT for a change in a state highway through the county, but the county on a county road, my understanding, sets. There's representatives from the Department of Transportation here.
What I was groping for is we may not be too far away from a compromise between these two. If the only issue between the bill we have and the DASTRI amendments is whether we're talking about a basic rule on the interstates as opposed to limits on the interstates, then I think we're much closer to dealing with this without the whole set of DASTRIs. And if that is what it is, then we have some time to work it out. I feel a lot more comfortable talking about basic rule on the interstate. I mean, that's a pretty easy fix to the bill we have in front of us.
Representative Mabry.
Mr. Chair, I would move the DASTRI amendments to Senate Bill 183.
Representative Mabry moves the DASTRI amendments to Senate Bill 183. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'll be a no vote on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, so will I.
Do we have a chance to hold this for a day or two?
We'll have to have some conflict amendments drafted also to bring back to this bill.
And this is a huge amount of amendments to see what the consequences are. I thought I had figured out what the bill was. So we're going to have some time to really
holding
this. So I can confirm with Representative Miller and we can figure out.
All right. I would have liked to have had a chance to hear from ODOT on their perspective on the DASTRI amendment.
Okay. Let's see. Representative Mabry, would you care to withdraw your motion?
If you say so,
okay.
Chief.
Thank you, sir. Representative. What I'll do is ask, We're running short of time, so I'll bring back the bill next time, and we'll consider the Dash 3 amendments and get some testimony from ODOT and anyone else that's here. Oh, let's see, we got about 5 minutes. Maybe we could hear from Lieutenant Miller. Gary Miller, is that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. And yeah. Right quickly. Any questions of the lieutenant? The lieutenant from the state police.
Well, I think I need to know what 3 does. But if we really are only talking about what we had in the original bill, limits inside cities, basic rule everywhere outside, and on the interstates, I guess I would ask the lieutenant whether basic rule on the interstates is a problem. I mean, if that is, if we can come to that simple agreement, I feel pretty comfortable unless somebody's really worried about basic rule on the interstate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I haven't seen the Dash 3 amendments, and I would like to have a chance to review them, talk with the Oregon Department of Transportation. It may or may not have issues that I'm aware of.
Representative Zoner?
No.
Yeah. Troy, could I have you come up too, please? Representative Beyer had some questions.
Well, first off, thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you seen the Dash 3 amendments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, Troy Costales, Administrator of the Transportation Safety Division for ODOT. No, I have not seen the Dash 3 amendments, and I'm unable to respond to any specifics.
Well, I would like to have feedback from him after he has seen the Dash 3 amendments.
Mm-hmm. I concur, Mr. Chair.
No other questions? All right, thank you. A couple minutes. Richard Burke, did...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. For the record, I'm Richard Burke. I'm Executive Director of the Libertarian Party. The reason why I wanted to speak on this is because we have, for many years, been in favor of things like the basic rule. And although there is, the basic rule is a subjective standard, which creates challenges that are unique, this is the reason why we support it. We think it is important that people hold legitimacy behind the laws that we have and that they respect the laws that we have, not just to the point where they're afraid they may get caught and penalized, but to the point where they understand that it is a reasonable law. Every day when I come down here, I drive about 80 miles an hour, and I get passed by about a third or half the cars that are on the road with me. This tells me that people believe that this is a ridiculous law. It's an arbitrary number, and I believe that when we have speed limits based on arbitrary numbers, what you do is you undermine the legitimacy of that law in the minds of the people who are forced to obey them. And I think that that's a problem generally on our highways. There's also, I hate to use a Star Trek metaphor, but I'm going to. I don't know if you ever saw an episode where they said there's a card named Fizbin. 3 jacks are good unless it's Tuesday, unless, of course, it's night, in which case you have a cronk and you win. If you go highway, basic rule, freeway, no basic rule, this situation, basic rule, the other basic rule, you know, you don't know where you are. You have speed limit numbers that are posted, but what is not posted is where the basic rule is and where it is not. Now, I understand, as I'm sure that everyone else does, that there are some places like schools and special zones where you do have to have some explicit limits. But generally speaking, I think it would be good to establish a culture where we have the basic rule standard and people understand that common sense is what rules. And although it is subjective, I would have to respectfully disagree with Representative Greenlick. I think people do know when they're pushing the envelope of safety. You know, I've got a 5 o'clock appointment. I got to get there. And they know they may be driving faster than they probably should, darting in and out, passing highways. I think that people know when they see a yellow light and they plow through it so that they don't have to stop at the red, or they want to, you know, they're trying to avoid the photo radar. I think people do generally know when they're driving too fast. And I think that common sense is a good rule, and it will enhance the confidence people have in the rule, because they will know that it is not an arbitrary number, despite what the sign says. It is a common sense figure, and I just wanted to go on record as supporting it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Committee, I intend to, I'll bring, we'll get the conflict amendments for the Dash 3 drafted, get the physical, and we'll bring this back next week, or next Wednesday, and deal with it. Right. Close the work session.
Mr. Chair, before we close the committee meeting, I just wanted to let the members know that I have made copies, or actually Ryan has passed them out. It was in my opinion piece that ran in Sunday's Oregonian by a friend of mine who is handicapped, and it's all about parking and the abuse of parking in handicapped spaces. And I think since we heard a bill on this several weeks ago, I thought it might be of interest to the committee members.
Thank you, Representative. Is there anything else?
No.
We're adjourned.